meaning to maintain an aloof, calculating stance toward human suffering. But for a moment, she felt a deep empathy for the man in front of her. Dadaji Holkar, for all the prestige of his current status as the Peshwa of India's most ancient and noble dynasty, was a low-caste scribe in his origins. After the Malwa had conquered Andhra, Dadaji and his whole family had been sold into slavery. Belisarius had purchased Holkar while he was in India in order to use the man's literary skills to advance his plot against Vedanta Katra. In the end, Holkar had been instrumental in effecting Shakuntala's escape and had become her closest advisor. But his family, his wife, son, and two daughters, were still in captivity, somewhere in the vastness of Malwa, India. It was typical of Holkar, she thought, that he would even hesitate to ask for a personal favor. Most Indian officials, most officials of any country in her experience, took personal favors as a matter of due course. She smiled, brushing back her hair. It's not a problem, Dadaji. It will be an opportunity, actually. To begin with, it'll give my spies a challenge. The Malwa run an excellent espionage service, but they have grown too confident and sure of themselves. Quite easy to penetrate, actually. Whereas finding a few Maratha slaves scattered across India will test their skills. She pursed her lips, thinking for a moment, before adding, and there's more. I've been thinking, anyway, that we should start probing the sentiments of the lower classes in Malwa, India. A very good way to do that is to have my spies scouring India for some Maratha slaves. Can you find them? He asked in a whisper. I can promise you nothing, Dadaji, but I will try. He nodded and left. Irene returned to her chair, but she hadn't read more than a page of the Periplus when the servant announced another visitor. The Bodhisvapadeva is here. Irene rose again. She was interested and a bit annoyed to find that her emotions were unsettled. She was even more interested, and not annoyed at all, to realize that she had no idea why Kungus had come. I like surprises. I get so few of them. When Kungus came into her chamber, Irene got her first surprise. As soon as he entered, he glanced over his shoulder and said, I saw Dadaji leaving just a minute ago. I don't think he even noticed me. He seemed so preoccupied. Kungus swiveled his head back to face her. He came to speak to you about his family, he stated, to ask you for your help in finding them. Irene's eyes narrowed. How did you know? Kungus made the little shoulder twitch which served him for a shrug. There are only two reasons he would come here right after the session in the Imperial Audience Chamber. That is one of them. Like everyone else, he was impressed by your spy network. And the other reason? Kungus seemed to be examining her carefully. The other reason would be to discuss with you the question of Emperor Shakuntala's marriage prospects. He is much concerned with that subject and would want to enlist the support of the Roman envoy. Kungus looked away for a moment in a quick scrutiny of the chamber. The furniture he gave no more than a glance, but his gaze lingered on a chest in the corner. The lid was open, and he could see that it was full of books. When his eyes returned to Irene, she thought there was some impish humor lurking within them. She got her second surprise. But I knew that couldn't be it. He wouldn't have left so soon. You don't agree with him, I think, and so he would have stayed to argue. How do you know my opinion? She demanded. Again, the little shoulder twitch. It is not obvious, no. Nothing about you is obvious. But I don't think you agree that the Empress should make a dynastic marriage with one of the independent South Indian monarchies. Irene studied Kungus for a moment in silence. No, I don't, she said slowly. I'm not certain of my opinion yet, mind you. But I think... She hesitated. Kungus held up his hand. Please, I'm not prying, envoy from Rome. We can discuss this matter at a later time when you think it more suitable. For the moment, a very faint smile came to his lips. Let me just say that I suspect you look at the thing as I do. A monarch should marry the power which can uphold the throne, And so the thing is obvious to any but these idiot Indians with their absurd fetishes. Irini suppressed her little start of surprise, but Kungus's eyes were knowing. "So I thought," he murmured. "Very smart woman." He turned away, heading for the door. "But that is not why I came," he said. "A moment, please. My servant is carrying something for me." Irini watched while Kungus took something from the servant who appeared in the doorway. When he turned back, she got her third surprise. Kungus was carrying a stack of books. He held them out to her. "Can you read these?" Hesitantly, Irini took the top book and opened it. She began to scan the first page, then stopped, frowning. "This isn't Greek," she muttered. "I thought it was, but..."
"The lettering is Greek," explained Kungus. "When we Kushans conquered Bactria long ago, we adopted the Greek alphabet, but the language is my own."
He fumbled with the stack of books, drawing out a slim volume buried in the middle.
"This might help," he said. "It's a bilingual translation of some of the Buddha's teachings. Half Greek, half Kushan."
His lips twitched.
"Or so my friend Dadaji tells me. He can read the Greek part. I can't read any of it. I'm not literate."
Irini set the first book down on a nearby table and took the one in Kungus's outstretched hand. She began studying the volume. After a few seconds, without being conscious of the act, she moved over to her chair and sat down. As ever, with true bibliophiles, the act of reading had drawn her completely out of her immediate surroundings. 2 minutes later, she remembered Kungus. Looking up, she saw that the Kushan was still standing in the middle of the room watching her.
"I'm sorry," she said.
She waved her hand at a nearby chair.
Kungus shook his head.
"I'm quite comfortable, thank you."
He pointed to the book.
"What do you think?"
Irini looked down at the volume in her lap.
"I could, yes," she looked up. "But why should I? It will be a considerable effort."
Kungus nodded. Then, slowly, he moved over to the one window in her room and stared out at the ocean. The window was open, letting in the cooling breeze.
"It is difficult to explain," he said, speaking as slowly as he had moved.
He fell silent for a few seconds before turning back to her rather abruptly.
"Do you believe there is such a thing as a soul?" he asked.
Somehow the question didn't surprise her.
"Yes," she replied instantly, "I do."
Kungus fingered his wispy beard.
"I am not so sure myself."
He stared back through the window.
"But I have been listening to my friend Dadaji this past year, and he has half convinced me that it exists."
Again, Kungus fell silent. Irini waited. She wasn't impatient. Not at all. When Kungus spoke again, his voice was very low.
"So I have decided to search for my soul to see if I have one. But a man with a soul must look to the future and not simply live in the present."
He turned his eyes back to her. He had attractive eyes, Irini thought. Almond-colored as they were almond-shaped. Such a contrast when you actually studied them to the dull armor of his features. The eyes were very clear and very bright. There was life dancing in those eyes, gaily, far in the background.
"I have never done that before," he explained. "Always I lived simply in the present. But now, for some months now, I have found myself thinking about the future."
His gaze drifted around the room, settling on a chair not far from Irene's own. He moved over and sat in it.
"I have been thinking about Peshawar," he mused. "That was the capital of our Kushan kingdom long ago. It is nothing but ruins today, but I have decided that I would like to see it restored after Malwa is broken."
"You are so confident of breaking, Malwa?" asked Irini.
As soon as she spoke the words, she realized they were more of a question about Kungus than they were about the prospects of war.
Kungus nodded. "Oh yes, quite certain."
His mask-like face made that little cracking movement which did for a smile.
I am not so certain, of course, that I myself will live to see it. But there is no point in planning for one's own death. So I keep my thoughts on Peshawar.
He studied her carefully.
But to restore Peshawar, I would have to be a king myself. So I have decided to become one. After the fall of Malwa, Shakuntala will no longer need me. I will be free to attend to the needs of my own Kushan people.
Irene swallowed. Her throat seemed dry.
I think you would make a good king, she said a bit huskily.
Kungus nodded.
I have come to the same conclusion.
He leaned forward, pointing to the volume in her lap.
But a king should know how to read, certainly his own language, and I am illiterate.
He leaned back, still-faced.
So now you understand.
Again, Irene swallowed.
You want me to learn Kushan so that I can teach you how to read it?
Kungus smiled.
And some other languages. I should also, I think, know how to read Greek and Hindi.
Abruptly, Irene stood up and went to a table against the wall. She poured some wine from an amphora into a cup and took a swallow. Without words, she offered a cup to Kungus. He shook his head. Irene poured herself another drink. After finishing that second cup, she stared at the wall in front of her.
Most men, she said harshly, do not like to learn from a woman. And learning to read isn't easy, Kungus, not for a grown man. You will make many mistakes. You will be frustrated. You will resent my instructions and my corrections. You will resent me.
She listened for the answer, not turning her head.
Most men, said Kungus softly, have a small soul. That, at least, is what my friend Dadaji tells me, and he is a scholar. So I have decided, since I want to be a king, that I must have a large soul, perhaps even a great one.
Silence. Irene's eyes were fixed on the wall. It was a blank wall with not so much as a tapestry on it.
I will teach you to read, she said. I will need a week to begin learning a language. After that, we can begin.
She heard the faint sounds of a chair scraping. Kungus was getting up.
We will have some time then, came his voice from behind her, before I have to leave on the expedition to destroy the guns.
Silence. Irene didn't move her eyes from the wall, not even after she heard Kungus going toward the door. He didn't make much sound, as quietly as he moved. Odd, really, for such a thick-looking man. From the doorway, she heard his voice.
I thank you, envoy from Rome.
My name is Irene, she said, harshly, coldly.
She didn't miss the softness in Kungus's voice, or the warmth.
Yes, I know. But I have decided it is a beautiful name, and so I did not wish to use it without your permission.
You have my permission.
Her voice was still harsh and cold. The arrogant voice of a Greek noblewoman bestowing a minor favor on an inferior. Silently, she cursed that voice.
Thank you, Irene.
A few faint sounds of footsteps came. He was gone. Irene finally managed to tear her eyes away from the wall. She started to pour herself another cup of wine, but stopped the motion midway. With a firm hand, she placed the cup back on the table and strode to the window. Leaning on the edge, she stared out at the ocean, breathing deeply. She remained there for some time, motionless, until the sunset. Then, moving back to her chair, she took up the slim volume and began studying her newfound task. She spent the entire evening there and got her final surprise of the day. For the first time in years, she wasn't able to concentrate on a book.
Chapter 7. Persia, Spring, 532 AD.
You're right, Morris, said Belisarius, lowering his telescope. They're not going to make a frontal assault.
Morris grunted. The sound combined satisfaction with regret.
satisfaction that his assessment had proven correct, regret because he wished it were otherwise. The Kiliarch examined the fieldworks below them. From the rise where he and Belisarius were standing, the Roman entrenchments were completely bare to the eye, but from the slope below where the Rajput cavalry was massed, they would have been almost invisible. Almost, but not quite. Again, he grunted. This time the noise conveyed nothing but regret.
Beautiful defenses, he growled. Damn near perfect. Pure killing ground once they got into it.
His gaze scanned the mountainous terrain around them.
Doesn't look like too bad a slope, not from below. And this is the only decent pass within miles.
Belisarius's eyes followed those of Morris. This stretch of the Zagros range wasn't high, measured in sheer altitude, but it was exceptionally rugged. There was little vegetation on the slopes, and those slopes themselves, for all their rocky nature, were slick and muddy from the spring runoff. Little rills and streams could be seen everywhere. Impossible terrain for cavalry, except for the one pass in which Belisarius had positioned his army. He had designed his defenses carefully, making sure that their real strength wasn't visible from the plateau below. The temptation for an enemy commander would be almost overwhelming. A powerful surging charge, clear the pass, the road to Mesopotamia and its riches would lie wide open. The only alternative would be to continue the grueling series of marches and countermarches which had occupied both the Roman and Malwa armies for the past several weeks. Almost overwhelming for any but the best commanders, like the ones who, unfortunately, commanded the Malwa forces ranged against them. You were right, Belisarius pronounced again. He cocked an eye at his chief subordinate and smiled his crooked smile. Think I've gotten sloppy, do you, from dealing with those Malwa thickheads in Mesopotamia? Morris scowled. I wasn't criticizing, General. It was a good plan, worth a try. But I didn't think Sangha would fall for it. Lord Demodera might have on his own, maybe. But it's been obvious enough the past month that he listens to Sangha. Belisarius nodded. For a moment his eyes were drawn to a pavilion on the plateau below. The structure was visible to the naked eye, but even through a telescope it wasn't much to see. For 2 days now, while the Malwa army gathered its forces below the pass, Belisarius had scrutinized that pavilion through his telescope. The distance was too great to discern individual features, but Belisarius had spotted Sangha almost immediately. The Rajput king was one of the tallest men Belisarius had ever met, and he had no doubt of the identity of the towering figure that regularly came and went from the pavilion, nor of the identity of the short, pudgy man who often emerged from it in Sangha's company. That would be Lord Demodera, the top commander of the Malwa army in the plateau. One of the Anvia Prapta Sachevya, as the Malwa called the hereditary caste that dominated their empire, blood-kin to Emperor Skandagupta himself. From the moment Belisarius had first seen that pavilion, he had been struck by it. It was nothing fancy, nothing elaborate, and by Malwa standards, positively austere. The structure was completely unlike the grotesque cotton and silk palace which Emperor Skandagupta had erected at the siege of Ranipur. And Belisarius was quite certain that Lord Venandakatra, the Anvia Prapta Sachevya whom the Roman general knew best, would have disdained to use it for anything other than a latrine. Beyond the nature of the pavilion itself, Belisarius had been just as struck, more so, perhaps, by the use to which it was put. In his past experience, Malwa headquarters were the scenes of great pomp and ceremony. Such pavilions, or palaces, or luxury barges, were invariably surrounded by a host of elite bodyguards. Visitors who arrived were accompanied by their own resplendent entourages and with great fanfare. Great fanfare. Kettledrums, heralds, banners, even trained animals prancing their way before the mighty lords and ladies of Malwa. Not Demodera's pavilion. There had been a steady stream of visitors to that utilitarian structure, true enough, but they were obviously officers, Rajputs in the main, with the occasional Yetai or Kshatriya, and they invariably arrived either alone or in small groups, not a bodyguard to be seen, except for the handful posted before the pavilion itself. And those, For a moment, Belisarius was tempted to use his telescope again, to study the soldiers standing guard before Demodera's pavilion. But there would be no point. He would simply see the same thing he had seen for the past 2 days, the thing which had impressed him most about that pavilion. Rajput guards. Always. Never Yetai. That single, simple fact had told him more than anything else. The Yetai were barbarians. Half a century earlier, they had erupted into the plains of North India and begun conquering the region, as they had already done with the Kushan territories to the northwest. But when they came up against the newly rising Malwa realm, an offshoot of the collapsing Gupta Empire, their advance was brought to a halt. Already, Belisarius now knew, the being from the future called Link had armed the Malwa with gunpowder technology. With their rockets, cannons, and grenades, the Malwa had defeated the Yetai. But then, instead of simply subjugating the barbarians, the Malwa had incorporated them into their own power structure, and in fact given them a prized and prestigious place, just below that of the Anvayaprapta Sachavya themselves. The Yetai clan chiefs had even been allowed to marry into the elite castes. The move was extraordinarily shrewd, commented Aid, and quite beyond the capacity of normal Hindu rulers to even envision. The instructions must have come from Link itself. The Yetai are not part of the caste and class structure of Hindu society, but Indians themselves call the Varna system. By giving such heathen barbarians a place in the elite, Link has provided a powerful and reliable Praetorian guard for the Malwa dynasty, which is its creature. Mentally, Belisarius nodded his agreement. That was how the Malwa invariably used their Yetai forces. The barbarians were ferocious warriors in their own right, but the Malwa, instead of using them as spearhead troops, used them as security and control battalions. Except for Demodera. Again, Belisarius made that mental nod. Demodera had placed his Yetai contingents with his fighting forces and relied solely on Rajputs for his own protection. The Rajputs were treasured by the Malwa for their military skills, just as was true of their Kushan vassals. But they weren't trusted. Except by Demodera, aid, just as you say. The Rajputs form the bulk of his army, and he's obviously decided to weld them to himself by giving them his final trust. Belisarius sighed faintly. All of which tells me a great deal, none of which I'm happy to know. This had been Belisarius's first opportunity to study his opponent at close hand. Roman and Malwa contingents had clashed several times in the weeks which had elapsed since his narrow escape from the ambush at the oasis, but the forces involved had been small. For the most part, the Romans and the Malwa had kept their distance, as each army tried to outmaneuver the other through the labyrinth of the Zagros range. The Romans had had the best of it, in a narrow sense. Belisarius was simply trying to block the Malwa from passing through the Zagros onto the open plain of Mesopotamia. He had succeeded in doing so, true, but Demodera and Sangha handled their own forces extremely well. They hadn't dislodged the Romans blocking their way, but they had slowly succeeded in forcing them back. The Zagros was a wide range, but it wasn't inexhaustible. Sooner or later, Belisarius would run out of room to maneuver, so he had decided to fight a battle on his own chosen terrain. If he could badly bloody the Malwa, he would gain more time, possibly even regain some lost ground. Against the normal run of Malwa commanders, his plan would have worked. Against Demodera and his Rajputs, it had failed, just as Morris had predicted. Belisarius raised his telescope and studied Demodera's pavilion, trying to discern anything inside the dark interior. It was a vain enterprise, more born from habit than anything else. But suddenly, and surprisingly, Aid spoke urgent words. There's a telescope in there. I can just barely make it out. Belisarius focused his own eyesight, but even with Aid's help, he couldn't see the telescope, which was apparently hidden within the pavilion. He wasn't surprised, however. Aid could often detect things through Belisarius's eyes, which the general himself could not. Big, clumsy damn thing, came Aid's mental sniff. Still, nothing.
Belisarius knew that Aid was using his own crystalline version of what the jewel called computer image enhancement.
Is this important? Asked Aid.
In and of itself, not especially. If that telescope's as big and awkward as you say, it's not going to be much of a help on the battlefield. But the fact that Demodera has one is interesting, nonetheless. It's a reminder to us not to underestimate the Malwa. Belisarius folded up his telescope. As so often before, in doing so, he was struck by the clever design of John of Rhodes' device. But for all that, his motion was sharp and decisive.
That's it, then, he announced, turning away.
Pass the word, Morris. We'll leave a unit here on guard, but get the army ready for another march. He gestured with his head toward the enemy below. They'll be moving out themselves sometime tonight. Make sure Abu and his scouts are close enough to see which route they take.
Won't be very close, replied Morris grimly. Not with Rajput flankers.
Belisarius began striding toward his own tent some 50 yards down the trail. Over his shoulder, he said, I'm well aware of that. Just close enough, Morris, that's all. Just close enough. If that army ever breaks contact with us, we'll be in a sea of trouble. A few steps away, hearing the exchange, Valentinian scowled.
I was afraid this was going to happen. God, I'm sick of marching.
He cast a half-hoping, half-skeptical eye at the Malwa army on the plateau below.
You think if I tried taunting them again...
Next to him, Anastasius snorted sarcastically.
And just what do you think that'll accomplish, besides making you look like an idiot? Again.
2 miles away, at the entrance to his pavilion, Lord Demodera straightened up from his own telescope. Then, feeling the usual ache, the Malwa general grimaced.
Wish I had one of his telescopes, he grumbled.
Standing next to him, Rana Sangha cast a glance at the optical device in question. The Malwa telescope, quite unlike the slender handheld artifact which he had seen in Belisarius's hands, was an ungainly thing. As in many areas, steelmaking was one outstanding exception. Indian craftsmanship was not the equal of Greek. The Malwa approach to optics was much like their approach to shipbuilding. Since we can't make it elegant, we'll make it big and sturdy. Big and sturdy, the Malwa telescope certainly was. So big, unfortunately, that it had to be supported on a rigid framework which could only be adjusted with great difficulty. The end result was that anyone who used the thing was forced to stoop in an awkward posture which, after a period of time, invariably resulted in back pain. For a moment, Sangha was tempted to point it out that Demodera, as short as he was, suffered less from the problem than did Sangha himself. But he restrained the impulse. Lord Demodera maintained an easy and informal bearing around his top subordinates, but he was Anveya Prapta Sachivya. There were limits. Instead, he opted for the bright side.
It's a better telescope than he has, he pointed out, at least as far as its strength goes.
Judging from his snort, Demodera wasn't mollified.
And so what? He demanded.
He gestured through the open flap of the pavilion.
So I can discern his features where he can't mine? On the rare occasions when he happens to wander into my field of view, that is. Well, he, for his part, can look anywhere he wants, without breaking his spine in the process.
Demodera rubbed his back, still grimacing.
I'd trade with him in a minute. And so would you, Rana Sangha, so stop trying to cheer me up.
Sangha said nothing. After a few seconds, Demodera stopped scowling. The young Malwa lord's innate good humor returned.
There's this much, Demodera said cheerfully. I'm quite sure he doesn't know we have a telescope. We didn't have them when he was in India, and I'm positive he hasn't spotted mine.
He glanced around his headquarters. The telescope was positioned 10 feet inside the entrance, well within the gloom of his pavilion's interior. Demodera had kept it there at all times, despite the limited field of view which the position provided, precisely in order to keep Belisarius from spotting the device. For an instant, the scowl returned.
I'm not sure that makes any difference, of course, but...
He shrugged.
With Belisarius, I'll take any advantage I can get.
Demoto returned away from the telescope and moved toward the large table located at the very center of the pavilion. Sangha, without being asked, immediately followed. At the edge of the table, Demotora planted his pudgy hands and leaned over, intently examining the huge vellum map which covered most of it. His gaze now was one of satisfaction rather than disgruntlement. Whatever they lacked in optical craftsmanship, no one could fault the skill of Marwa mapmakers. He was especially pleased with the topographical information which his chief cartographer managed to include. Demotora peered into a corner of the dimly lit pavilion. As always, his cartographer was waiting patiently, seated on a small cushion. Narses was also in the corner, available in case Demotora needed his advice. The eunuch, following Roman custom, sat in a chair.
"It's up to date, Lord Demotora," said the mapmaker. "Just this morning I incorporated the latest information brought in by the Pathans."
Demotora nodded and turned back to the map. For a time, he was silent, examining the terrain shown thereon. At his side, Rana Sangha did the same. Then, Lord Demotora reached out and placed his finger on a location some 15 miles to the south. "There, perhaps?" he asked. "Judging from the map, it seems like an obscure pass. Very narrow, but it might be enough." Sangha studied the pass in question for a moment before shaking his head. The gesture was more one of slow consideration, however, than firm judgment.
"I don't think so, Lord."
He hesitated, tugging at his rich beard.
"I'm not sure of this, you understand, but it seems to me that Belisarius has been especially keen to thwart us from making any headway to the south. I suspect that he already has scouts watching the approaches to that pass."
Demotora looked up, his eyes widening. He seemed slightly startled.
"To the south especially? I hadn't..."
He frowned, thinking, then chuckled ruefully. "It seemed more to me that he was thwarting us anywhere we went." Sangha's shoulders lifted in a small shrug.
"That is true, Lord, but I still think that he has been quickest of all to prevent us from going south."
Demotora spread his hands on the table, staring at the map. It was obvious to Sangha, watching the movement of his eyes, that Demotora was retracing every step of the past month's maneuvers.
"I think you're right," he murmured after a minute or two.
Demotora straightened up, staring now at the bare leather of the pavilion wall across from him.
"Why is that, do you think?" he mused thoughtfully.
His gaze turned to Sangha.
"It doesn't make any sense. What difference does it make whether we bypass him to the north or the south? So long as we can keep him from making westward progress, he keeps us out of Mesopotamia, tied up here in these miserable mountains."
Demotora's eyes returned to the map.
"If anything," he added slowly, "I would think he'd prefer to maneuver us south. That way he can keep us following the Zagros Range all the way to the Gulf."
He pointed to the southern reaches of the mountains shown on the map.
"In the end, we might find ourselves emerging into Mesopotamia down at the Delta, near Karax."
He laughed sarcastically. "Where he already has our main army bottled up, with Emperor Khosrow and his lancers to keep the cork in the bottle." Sangha's beard tugging grew more vigorous.
"There is one possible explanation, especially dealing with Belisarius."
Lord Demotora cocked his head, peering up at the tall Rajput next to him.
"A trap," he stated.
Sangha nodded. Demotora began pacing back and forth slowly. His hands, in one of the Malwa Lord's characteristic gestures, were clasped in front of him as if he were in prayer. But the short, jabbing back and forth motion of the hands conveyed concentration rather than piety.
"You could be right," he mused.
A sudden bark, half humorous, half exasperated.
"Subtle bait. But that is the way the man thinks."
Demotora suddenly stopped his pacing and turned to face Sangha squarely.
"What do you advise?" he demanded.
Sangha stopped his beard tugging and took a deep breath.
"Go north," he said firmly.
"It may be a trap, Lord Demotora. He may be laying an ambush for us. But traps can be turned against the trapper. A trap designed for a wolf will not necessarily hold a tiger. Our troops are excellent,
and our army outnumbers his by 2-1.
The murderer nodded.
Closer to 3-1, I think.
The Malwa lord's eyes grew a bit vacant. Again, his hands were clasped before him in the gesture of prayer, but there was no emphatic jabbing this time. The hands were still, except for a slight flexing of the fingers. Sangha, recognizing the signs, waited. As usual, Demodera didn't take long to make his decision.
I agree, the lord said firmly. We will go north.
He barked another laugh.
With our eyes wide open, and...
There was a sudden commotion at the entrance to the pavilion. Demodera and Sangha turned. They saw that two of the Lord Rajput's guards were barring the way of a Yetai who, for his part, was expressing his anger in no uncertain terms. It was General Mihi Rakula, the commander of Demodera's Yetai troops. Let him in, called out Demodera. The guards stepped aside, and Mihi Rakula stormed into the pavilion. He cast an angry glance at Rana Sangha before coming to a halt in front of Lord Demodera.
What is this nonsense I hear? Demanded Mihi Rakula. I was just informed by one of your...
Another angry glance at Sangha.
Rajput dispatch riders that we are to make preparations for a march. Is this true?
The question was obviously rhetorical. Mihi Rakula didn't wait for an answer before gesturing angrily at the mountains visible through the open flap of the pavilion.
Why are we not charging the stinking Romans? He demanded. We will brush them aside like flies.
Again, Mihi Rakula glared at Sangha.
If the Rajputs are too fearful, then my Yetai will lead the way.
The Yetai general was a big man, heavy in the shoulders and thick in the chest. But Sangha was as much taller than he as Mirakula was than Demodera. The Rajput drew himself up to his full towering height. His hands were clasped tightly behind his back, but it was obvious from the tension in Sangha's powerful arms that he was barely controlling his anger. Demodera intervened quickly. He placed a slight restraining hand on Sangha. To the Yetai general, he stated firmly, "The orders were mine, General Mihi Rakula." Demodera made his own gesture toward the mountains. "The Roman fieldworks here are too powerful, but," he added, overriding the Yetai's gathering splutter of protest, "my scouts tell me that we may find a way to the north." Again, he overrode Mihi Rakula's protest. This time, saying with a cheerful smile, "The scouts think there will be opposition, of course, so I was thinking of using you and your men as my vanguard element in the next march." The smile Demodera was bestowing on Mihi Rakula was positively a beam now. "To clear the way for us, of course, so that we can finally be done with these damned mountains." Mihi Rakula relaxed a bit. He glanced at Sangha once again before replying to Demodera, but the glance had more of satisfaction in it than anger.
"Soon, do you think? My men are very restless."
Demodera shrugged.
"Soon enough. Within a week, I imagine."
He made a little apologetic grimace. "Marching through these mountains, as you know, is not a quick business." All apology and goodwill vanished. Demodera's next words were spoken in a tone of steel. "And now, General Mihi Rakula, you will carry out my commands at once." The Yetai commander knew that tone. For all his barbarous nature, Mihi Rakula was not a fool. He bowed his head stiffly and departed from the pavilion. After he was gone, Sangha let out a short, angry grunt.
"My Rajputs can lead," he began, but Demodera waved him silent.
"I am well aware of that, Sangha. But the Yetai are getting restless." He gave Sangha a shrewd glance. "So are your Rajputs, for that matter, even if they control their impatience better." Demodera pointed at the map. His finger made little wandering gestures as if retracing the torturous route of the past weeks. "Good soldiers grow impatient with this kind of endless maneuvering. Sooner or later they will demand action. You know that as well as I do." Grudgingly, Sangha nodded. Demodera spread his hands. "So let the Yetai lead the way for now. If there is a trap, they will spring it. To be frank, I'd rather see them bloodied than you." It was plain enough from the look on his face that Sangha found his commander's cold-bloodedness distasteful. But Demodera took no offense.
He simply chuckled. I am Malwa Ranasanga, not Rajput. Practical.
2 days later, Belisarius was studying a map spread across a table in his own field headquarters. All of his top commanders were joining him in the enterprise. Those included, in addition to Morris and Vasudeva, Ciro, who had succeeded Agathias in command of the Greek cataphracts after Agathias had been crippled at the Battle of Nahar Malka, and Buzis and Kutsis, the two young Thracian brothers who commanded the Syrian contingents in Belisarius's army. Abu entered, pushing his way through the leather flaps which served as an entrance. The chief of Belisarius's Arab scouts didn't wait for an invitation to speak before advancing to the center of the tent and giving his report. The old Bedouin didn't give the map so much as a glance. Abu was a stern traditionalist. Despite his deep, if unspoken, admiration for Belisarius, the Arab considered the map an alarming omen, either of the Roman general's early senility or of his rapid descent into modern decadence. "The Malwa are heading north," he announced, "toward that saddle pass I told you about. It's obvious they're expecting an ambush. They have their Yetai contingents leading the way." Abu grunted approvingly. "He's no fool, that Malwa commander. He'll feed the barbarians into the fire, good riddance, before following through with his Rajputs." "Before trying to follow through," said Cyril. Abu shook his head. The Bedouin's countenance, always dour, grew positively gloomy. "They will succeed. The pass is too wide and the slopes on either side not steep enough. The north slope is especially shallow. They will be able to use their numbers against us. It won't be easy, but they'll force their way through." Cyril began to bridle at the Arab's easy assumption of defeat, but Belisarius intervened. "That's just as well," he stated forcefully. "I want to steer them north. So we'll put up a stiff resistance at the pass itself, but withdraw before our men get mangled." He bent over, studying the map, then pointed with his finger. "If this is accurate, once they get through the pass, their easiest route will be to follow this small river to the northwest." He cocked an eye at Abu. The Arab scowled fiercely, but said nothing, which was his way of admitting that the newfangled absurdity couldn't be faulted. Belisarius kept his eye on Abu. "And if I'm reading this map correctly," he added, "when we fall back and set our positions southwest of the pass, our fieldworks will be too strong for the Malwa to take any other direction." Abu's scowl deepened, but again he said nothing. "If you don't want to hold the pass, General," asked Buzis, frowning, "then why even put up a fight at all? Seems like a waste of good soldiers." The young Thracian didn't bother to add, "which is not your usual style." Like all of the men in that tent, he had become very familiar with Belisarius's tactical methods. One of those methods, a very important one, was to be sparing with his men's lives whenever possible. Belisarius shook his head. "I don't have any choice, Buzis. I can't afford to make it too easy, not for commanders like Demotara and Sanga. If we fight like lions whenever they move south, but stand aside when they move north, they'll start to wonder why. Doesn't make sense. Strict military logic would be the other way around. I should be more than happy to steer them down the Zagros toward Pars." He winced. "I do not want Sanga and Demotara spending much time contemplating my bad logic." Morris interrupted. His own expression didn't exude any great happiness. "They're probably already doing that," he growled. Belisarius heaved a sigh. "Yes, I'm sure they are. But as long as they don't think too much about the Kanats and don't know about the Kushans, I think we'll be all right." He cast a quick glance at the helmet which Vasudeva had placed upon the table. As always, the Kushan had removed the detested monstrosity as soon as he entered the tent and was safe from spying eyes. Belisarius's expression resumed its usual calm serenity. He even managed a crooked smile. "My plan is, after all," he said cheerfully, "a bit on the crazed side." That announcement didn't seem to bring any great cheer to the other men in the tent, but they didn't protest, not at least beyond thinking private dark thoughts. Those men were all very familiar with Belisarius's tactical principles and methods, Many of those methods struck them as bizarre, but not the one which always stood at the very center. Win the war. That's all that matters. Chapter 8. Aksum, Spring 532 AD. Aeon's regimental ceremony didn't take place until days after the bombing of the Ta'aka Mariam. Initially, the prince had insisted on doing it at once, but calmer voices, older ones at least, prevailed. Foremost among those voices had been that of Wasi, the commander of the regiment itself. "There is no time now, King of Kings," he insisted. "I am not the Negus and the Ghast," roared Aeon. "I cannot be until I am accepted into the Takuan Sawe." The prince, king now, his father and brother's corpses had already been found, rose from his labors. Aeon had worked through the night, along with his soldiers and most of Aksum's populace, clearing away the rubble and debris. It was now mid-morning of the next day, and there was still much work to be done. The royal quarters themselves had been excavated, but the Malwa explosives had shattered well over a third of the great complex. Hundreds of corpses had been found, and as many survivors. The rescue workers could hear the faint moans of a few victims who were still alive buried beneath the stones. Wasi placed a gentle hand on Aeon's shoulder. "The Takuan can wait, King." The Takuan commander gestured with his head, indicating the knot of soldiers standing just a few feet behind him. Those men were all of the officers of the regiment, other than the ones who were with Ezana in India. "None of us are concerned about the matter." Hearing Wasi's words, the regimental officers growled their agreement. Several of them glanced at the figure of Usanas. The Dawaz was just a few yards away, oblivious to the exchange. He was too busy pulling away stones. Not even Aeon failed to miss the obvious approval in those glances. "There is no need," repeated Wasi softly. Then, very softly, in words only Aeon could hear, "No need, Aeon. There is no question of the regiment's approval of Usanas and you." Wasi chuckled, but again so softly that only Aeon could hear. "They will have harsh words to say, of course, about the hunter's ridiculous philosophies and will relish every detail of your childhood follies. But that is just tradition." He cast a glance at the distant figure of Antonina, who was directing her own soldiers in the rescue operation. All of the Roman troops had survived the explosion, and they had immediately pitched into the work. "They are especially looking forward to hearing about all the times Usanas was forced to slap you silly until you finally learned not to ogle the wife of Belisarius." Aeon managed to smile. It wasn't much of a smile, but Wasi was still relieved to see it. For just a fleeting instant, Aeon's was the face of a young man again. For hours, since the bodies of Zaya and Tarabai had been found, his face had been that of an old man broken with grief. Zaya had been his concubine since Aeon was 13 years old. If the passion had faded some from their relationship, he had still loved her deeply, and he had been almost besotted with Tarabai since he met her in India. "You lost everyone yesterday, Aeon," said Wasi gently. "Your women and your only child, along with your father and brother. No man in the world, prince or peasant, it matters not, can think clearly at such a time or deal with anything beyond his grief. So let us simply concentrate on the work before us. There will be time soon enough for the ceremony." He stepped back a pace and raised his voice slightly. "For the moment, you are the Negus and Agast. That is the opinion of the Takuan Sawe, as well as the Lazen and the Hadafan." Wasi gestured toward two of the officers in the cluster. They were named Aphilus and Saizana, and were respectively the commanders of the Lazen and the Hadafan Sawe. The Lazen had been the regiment of Caleb, the Hadafan that of Wazeb. Along with the Takuan, they constituted the current royal regiments of the Ethiopian army.
"That is correct, King," said Aphilus. Saizana nodded, adding, "And we have spoken to all of the other Sarawit. The soldiers are of one mind on this matter, all of them." Then, almost in a snarl, "We will have our vengeance on Malwa, and you are the King of Kings who will lead us to it." Aeon wiped his face with a hand, smearing dirt and rock dust. It was a weary, weary gesture.
"How is Garmot?" he asked. "Will he survive?"
Mossy broke into a smile of his own, and not a thin one, either.
"Be serious, King. If 20 great stones falling on that old Arab brigand couldn't kill him outright, do you really think he would die of lingering wounds?"
One of the officers, an older man, well into his 50s, laughed.
"I remember when we were chasing that bandit through the desert years ago. Never could catch him, no matter how many ambushes we laid."
Another officer, also middle-aged, grinned. "Personally, I think he's malingering, lazy half-breed, just doesn't want to haul stones." A little laugh swept the small crowd. Even Aeon joined in the humor for a moment. Finding Garmot had been the only brightness in a long, dark night. The advisor had apparently been standing some distance away from the throne when the bombs went off. The mob were saboteurs, of course, had set the main charges in the walls near the throne itself. When the explosion took place, King Caleb and all of the people in his immediate vicinity, including his oldest son and heir, Wazeb, had been pulverized by the great blast. The rest of the people in the throne room, except for Garmot and a servant, had been crushed by the falling roof and walls. But by a freak of fortune, some of the Ta'aka Mariam's great stones in their collapse had formed a sort of shelter for Garmot and the servant. The servant, in fact, had been almost unharmed, other than being frightened half out of her wits. Garmot's injuries had been severe, several broken bones along with innumerable bruises and lacerations, but his life had been spared. The news of Garmot's survival, as it spread, brought cheer to everyone, especially to the Samhain. Partly that was due to fondness for the man himself. King Caleb's rule had been good, so far as the people of Aksum were concerned. Much of that they ascribed to the sage and usually gentle advice of Garmot. But mostly, the news brought cheer to the soldiers laboring in the wreckage because it stirred flame in their fierce hearts. The Samhain hadn't forgotten that Garmot was the same wily half-Arab bandit who had eluded the Ethiopian army for years, until finally he had accepted their offer to become Caleb's own Dawaz when Aeon's father was still a boy. After Caleb succeeded to the throne, Garmot had been his chief advisor for years, until Caleb assigned him to serve Aeon in the same post. Gentle, the man Garmot had often been in his advice to Ethiopian royalty, but always shrewd, always cunning, and when he felt it necessary, as savage and pitiless as the Arabian desert which had shaped him. More than one Aksumite soldier, hearing the news that Garmot still lived, silently repeated Antonina's own thought. "Bad move, Malwa. Bad news, you bastards. You'd have done better to toy with a scorpion after tweaking its tail." 10 days after the explosion, the regimental ceremony was finally held. The fact that the Ta'aka Mariam was a ruin didn't impede the proceedings. By tradition, the ceremony was never held in the royal compound. It was always held on the training fields, where, Ethiopians never forgot, the real power of Aksum was created. The army's training fields were located about half a mile west by northwest of the royal compound, at the base of one of the two great hills which overlooked the capital. This hill, which formed the eastern boundary of Aksum, was called the Mykoho. The one on the north, the Bet Giorgis. Standing to one side in the group of witnesses who were not members of the regiments, Antonina surveyed the scene. She was impressed more than anything by the open, almost barren nature of the grounds. Other than the row of open-air thrones on the north end of the field, butted against the slopes of the Mykoho, the training grounds were completely bare except for a handful of wooden spear targets. That was the Aksumite way of looking at things, she realized. When she first arrived in Ethiopia, Antonina hadn't noticed the absence of fortifications until the officers of her army began pointing it out to her. They had been quite impressed. None of Aksum's towns, not even the capital city of Aksum itself, nor the great seaport of Adulis, were surrounded by walls. Not one of the many villages through which they passed on their long trek upcountry had so much as a small fortress to protect it. The ancient Athenians had placed their faith in the wooden walls of their ships, the Aksumites in the spears of their regiments. That was not from lack of ability. Aksumites were quite capable of massive stonework. The Ta'aka Mariam, and especially the glorious Cathedral of Mariam Tsion, were testimony to the skill and craftsmanship of Ethiopian masons. But those edifices were for pomp, display, ceremony, and worship. They had nothing to do with power. Power came from the regiments. They, and they alone. She brought her eyes back to the thrones at the north end of the field. Those two, she thought, testified to the same approach. The structures were identical and quite small. Nothing like Caleb's great throne in the Ta'aka Mariam had been. Each throne rested on a granite slab not more than 8 feet square. A smaller slab atop the first provided the base for the throne itself, which was a solid but simple wooden chair. Four slender stone columns rising from each corner of the upper slab supported a canopy which sheltered the occupant from the sun. A gold cross, very finely made, Aksumite metalsmiths were as skilled as their masons, surmounted the entire structure, but the canopy itself was made of nothing fancier than woven grass. Those thrones were for the commanders of the Aksumite Sarawit, the regiments into which their army was organized. It was typical of Aksumite notions of rule that those commanders, taken as a collective group, were called Nagast, kings. None of them, as individuals, enjoyed that title. Unlike the vassal states of the Ethiopian Empire, whose rulers retained their royal trappings, so long, of course, as they acknowledged the suzerainty of the King of Kings, the regimental commanders derived their authority entirely from the army itself. But in the real world, the attitude of the regiments was considered far more important than the vagaries of sub-kings. Only three of the thrones were occupied this day. Even that was unusual. According to tradition, one man alone should be sitting on a throne today, the commander of the Dekuan Sawe. Even the king himself, though he wasn't present, was required to vacate his throne in the royal compound until his son's regiment had passed its judgment. But Wasi had bent the custom today. With the murder of Caleb and Wazib, the Lazan and the Hadafan Sarawit had lost their own royalty. Wasi had offered, and they had accepted, to share the prince. For the first time in Aksumite history, a man would ascend the throne with the approval and the name of three regiments. The ceremony was beginning. Aeon was taking his own place, standing alone to one side. At the very front, before the assembled regiments themselves, Usanas was being brought forward. Antonina struggled mightily against a giggle. The dewaz was positively festooned with chains and manacles. The servile devices looked about as appropriate on him as ribbons on a lion. And probably, she thought, eyeing Usanas's tall and heavily muscled figure, just about as effective if he decides he's tired of the rigmarole. Belisarius had told her once after returning from India that Usanas was probably the strongest man he had ever met in his life, even stronger, he suspected, than the giant Anastasius. But Antonina's humor faded quickly enough. The chains and manacles might seem absurd, but there was nothing absurd-looking about the squad of soldiers who surrounded Usanas. There were eight of them, and all were holding weapons in their hands. These were not the usual stabbing spears and heavy cleaver-like swords with which Aksumites went into battle, however. The soldiers were holding clubs inlaid with iron studs. Weapons to beat a slave who had failed in his duty. Beat him to death easily enough if he had failed badly. Antonina, staring at those cruel implements, had no trouble with giggles. Not any longer. She knew the clubs weren't ornaments. It had happened over the past centuries that a regiment had beaten a dewaz savagely, fatally on two occasions, because they judged that he had failed in his duty to educate his prince. She tore her eyes away and looked at Aeon. The sight of the young royal's upright and square-shouldered stance reassured her. The calmness in his face, even more so. Not today. Not that prince. A minute later, the ceremony itself got underway. 5 minutes later, Antonina was fighting giggles again. 10 minutes later, she stopped trying altogether and joined in the general hilarity. She spent most of the day, in fact, laughing along with everyone else. Antonina had forgotten. There was a serious core, deadly serious, at the heart of that ceremony, but Axumites, when all was said and done, didn't hold solemnity in any great esteem. The best armor against self-aggrandizement and pomposity, after all, is always humor. By and large, the ceremony proceeded chronologically. Aeon's prepubescent follies were dismissed quickly enough. Everyone wanted to get to the next stage. Antonina learned then the reason for the other women standing in her group. All of them, it seemed, except for three old crones whose testimony had to do with Aeon's pranks in the royal kitchen, had been seduced by the young prince at one time or another. It was quite a crowd. Antonina was rather impressed. But she was more impressed, much more, by what followed. Most of the women were, or had been, servants in the royal compound while Aeon was in his teens. The kind of women in every land who were the natural prey of young male nobles feeling the first urges of budding sexuality. But they were not there, it developed, to press any grievances against the prince. They simply recounted, neither volunteering the information or responding to one of the many questions shouted out by soldiers in the ranks, the ways in which Aeon had finagled his way into their beds. Their statements were frank, open, usually jocular, and often at the expense of Aeon himself. It became clear soon enough that, especially in his earlier years, the prince's skill at working his way into their beds had not been matched by any great skill once he got there. Several of the tales were downright hilarious. Antonina was especially entertained by the account of a plump older woman who had once been a cook in the royal compound. The woman, she must have been a good 20 years older than Aeon, recounted in lavish detail her patient, frustrated attempts to instruct a headstrong 15-year-old prince in the basic principles of female anatomy. Not with any great success, it seemed, until she discovered the secret. Slap the fool boy on his head. That produced a gale of laughter, sweeping across the entire training field. The soldiers guarding Osanas grinned at him with approval. Unfortunately, Antonina couldn't follow all of the woman's tale. Her own knowledge of Ge'ez, the Axumite language, was still very poor. Menander, one of the cataphracts who had accompanied Belisarius on his trip to India, was serving as a translator. He'd become good friends with Wasi and Ezana during that long journey and was quite fluent in the language. Alas, Menander was also young, and he still bore the imprint of his conservative village upbringing. So, whenever the story got especially juicy, he fumbled and stumbled, and Antonina had no doubt was guilty of excessive abridgment. "And what was that about?" Antonina demanded, once the roaring laughter had subsided a bit. Menander fumbled and stumbled, abridged. "Ah," said Antonina, nodding her head wisely. "Yes, of course. It is difficult to teach a thick-headed male how to use his tongue for something more useful than boasting." But for all its salacious humor, there was still a deadly serious purpose to the business. As she listened to the questions which the soldiers asked of the women, Antonina understood that they were probing for something quite important. The soldiers weren't concerned, not in the least,